Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program that looks into the economic dimensions of our lives, our incomes, our jobs, our debts, our futures, the futures of our kids, all in terms of the economics that are involved. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write economics columns for a variety of publications, and in particular, the website truthout.org, a remarkable, independent, courageous source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. If this program and the analyses you hear on it are of interest, let me invite you to make use of our two websites that are available to you 24 hours a day at no charge. One is called rdwolf.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. They will contain news articles, selected interviews that I do, lectures, whole classes, a vast array of material, constantly supplemented and updated literally every day, available to you to make use of in any way you find valuable in whatever you do. The two websites also offer you two other capabilities. The first is to communicate to us, to tell us what you like and don't like about the program, to pose questions you would like to see answered. We're going to spend an extra bit of time today's program, for example, responding to your many questions. Please bear with us. We get more questions than we can possibly answer, but we read every one of your communications and use them to shape what we do on this program. And finally, both websites provide for you a way to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and thereby keep up with us even more closely to what we do on a day-to-day basis. So let me turn then to the short updates with which we begin every program. But before that, an announcement, actually three short announcements. First, I want to let those of you that either live in the Greater New York area or have occasion to come to the Greater New York area that I do a monthly economic update in person in the Judson Memorial Church, a historic church facing the historic Washington Square in Lower Manhattan. The second Wednesday of every month, I go there and we have an evening in which I present a monthly version of what this program does on a weekly basis. It is open, it is available, it is very inexpensive, a sliding scale for folks according to what they can afford. But the whole point is to do this kind of analysis live with a live audience and have a back and forth out of that process. So once again, I want to thank the Judson Memorial Church for hosting this event and invite you all to make use of that as well. At the end of the month of September, I'm making two trips and speaking elsewhere in the United States. The first one towards the end is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the second one is in Baltimore, Maryland. Those of you in that area might be interested in attending or participating or following some of these events. Lastly, this program now airs on over 35 stations around the United States. Those of you that are listening to me are therefore part of a fairly large and rapidly growing family. We want to grow more quickly. If any of you listening knows of or is in touch with folks who run radio stations of any kind, of any size, we are willing and eager to talk with the folks at these stations about carrying this program. Please get in touch with us through the two websites if you can be a partner to what we're trying to do in that way. So now for the updates. First, I've been following the story of Market Basket, and that story has now come to an extraordinarily good conclusion, and I want to make sure you all know about it. Quickly to recap, Market Basket is a large chain of supermarkets located primarily in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine in New England. I believe it has in the neighborhood of 71 stores, so it's quite a sizable chain. It was owned and operated, still is, by a family, a fairly large family, the DeMoulas family, and they had conflicts, as most families do, and this one played out in the realm of how are you going to run this big corporation, which has thousands and thousands of employees and serves many more thousands of people in terms of their supermarket, their local supermarkets? One part of the family associated with Arthur T. Demoulas had a notion that a corporation should serve its community and serve its workers in a way that was serious, committed, and substantial. It should not be in business only for the bottom line of the top executives and the family that owned it. Another part of the family didn't agree, was more traditional in its capitalist notion that business is about serving the people who own it, first and foremost. They fought it out, and for a while, the company was taken over by the part of the family that is the more traditional capitalist part, taken away from the other, which had been in control. Then there was a fight, and as I reported earlier, the old wing recaptured control of the corporation when the rest of the family basically sold its shares to the part that was in tune with what workers and the community wanted. But I want to stress how it was done. When the wing of the family that wanted to convert the company to your traditional capitalist enterprise serving the people who own and the top executives, what we had was a revolt of the people led by the workers who brought in the larger community saying, we the people, the vast majority of those involved in this company who either work there or shop there, we the majority don't accept what the owners did. Let me make that really clear. The majority rose up and rejected a decision made by the minority who owned the company. And they showed that if the workers refuse to work for the company in the way that the family portion that took over wanted them to, and if the larger community was confronted with a corporation that works this way, the workers and the consumers together could basically withdraw their cooperation, in which case the company can't function. The shelves in the stores became empty. The shoppers found other places to buy. The workers said no. And in the end, the family, the owners, the capitalists, caved in, gave the company back to the wing of the family that the workers and the community demanded. There's an extremely important lesson here. It's obvious. Where the real power lies in capitalism is not where those who own and operate the businesses would like to have you believe it does. Here was a clear conflict in these three states in New England between the needs and desires of those who captured control, ownership, top executives, and the workers who wanted a different kind of company run in a different kind of way with a different part of the family. And when push came to shove, the workers and the community showed that they have the final say because they are the majority and they have the power if they're willing and able to use it. They did in this case, and they won in that struggle. Now just imagine with me if the workers in the community, understanding the power they had and used so effectively, were to decide that they have an interest not in picking the better of two sides of a family, which is what they did here, but if they themselves were in charge of what the enterprises did. Then they wouldn't depend on this or that squabble in a family. They wouldn't depend on which side of a family took over. They'd make sure the company and the enterprise served the majority, the workers and the community, and did not serve any minority, let alone the one whose only claim is they have the money. I wanted next to give you another update that may or may not please you. It has to do with the people who manage other people's money. stock brokerage, asset managers, they have many different names, but they're companies, most of which are located in a few of our biggest cities, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, and so on, who make money by managing the wealth of very wealthy individuals, wealthy families, and indeed wealthy corporations sometimes as well. And the Wall Street Journal's publication Market Watch, dated September 9th, 2014, in an article by Sital Patel, carried a list of the 10 highest paid asset manager CEOs. These are the heads of the companies who don't produce anything, who don't make anything. All they do is manage other people's money, and they charge a hefty fee for doing that. I thought I'd mention some of the big names and what they earn, just so you know. The richest, according to the Wall Street Journal, the richest asset manager, Mario Gabelli, G-A-B-E-L-L-I. His institution is called Gamco Investors, G for his name, Gabelli. In 2013, the last full year for which we have data, according to the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Gabelli took home $85 million, a bit more than that, but I'm rounding it out. Right after him were two names that some of you know if you follow what capitalists are doing in high finance, Henry Kravis and George Roberts, part of a company that bears their names, KKR. Henry Kravis, $44.2 million last year, and George Roberts, another $44.1. Why George Roberts got a little less than Henry Kravis, we'll leave to whatever they have to say to one another. Down on number 10, poor fellow, ranks only number 10, Sean Healy, head of Affiliated Managers Group, took home a mere $20 million. In other words, if you want to know who the rich are that are getting richer, you need to look really no further than the asset managers who are able to cash in by managing the money of the richest so that they get richer faster and along the way make these folks in Wall Street wildly wealthy as well. Next update has to do with the reinforcement of something I've been saying on this program, but from an unlikely and unexpected source. Every 3 years, the Federal Reserve System in the United States issues a document called the Consumer Finance Survey, or the Survey of Consumer Finances. And one has just been issued last week, covering the period from 2010 to 2013. And it shows crystal clearly in a variety of statistics that I just don't have the time to go over, what we have all been saying, that the so-called recovery of the last 3 years, 2010 through 2014, has only benefited the top 3 or 4%, basically. Everybody else's economic situation, their income, how much property they own, has all gone down and hasn't begun to recover, hasn't come back to where it was in 2006 and 7 before this crisis hit, hasn't even come close to that. So the word recovery doesn't apply to the majority of people, which is why the majority of people are angry, upset, feel badly about the economy, feel badly about the politicians running this economy, etc., together with the big businesses that sit behind those politicians and pull their strings. The next update, something that ought to get a lot more attention than it has. Over the last few days, and I'm using a press release from the Agence France-Presse, the leading news agency in France, China and Russia. China, the largest country by population on this planet, and Russia, the largest country by geography, by landmass on this planet, have got together and announced this week something they've been discussing at least since last May. They are going to collaborate on building the largest seaport in Northeast Asia on Russia's Sea of Japan. Now, let me comment on this. The United States, particularly its more conservative types, are busily rattling the sabers and threatening warfare and sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine issues, against China over a whole host of issues and conflicts, feeling very tough about wielding weapons and sending troops and sending advisors and, as we say, rattling the sabers. Whatever you think of that, the Russians and the Chinese are understanding that they have a common enemy in the United States and to some degree also Europe, although it's a little unclear which way Europe is going to go. But the Russians and the Chinese are forging links. They're building a port together to help both their economies. The Russians are paying for part of this by reorganizing where they ship the massive quantities of energy coming out from underneath the largest country on Earth, particularly the gas. The gas that used to be sold overwhelmingly to Europe, that gas is now going to flow in large part to China. China, whose development requires massive new sources of energy, which the West is hesitant to allow them to tap in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, they are now going to get their energy from Russia. There's an alliance building and strengthening and solidifying between the two largest countries by population and landmass on Earth. I wonder how many Americans think about what it means to do the maneuvers around Ukraine, to do the kind of fighting against the Chinese, bad-mouthing them at every chance that we have in the Western media, when we are perhaps provoking a problem much, much larger for the future of the United States and Western Europe than most people are willing to think about. The lack of attention given to these developments of cooperation between Russia and China may come back to haunt us in the years to come. Quickly, a few more headline stories. A Chipotle branch, a remarkable chain of restaurants across the United States, got in the news this last week when a Chipotle restaurant near the Pennsylvania State University in that state was closed by workers who denounced the conditions there, the bad wages, the bad working conditions, and all the rest. And when the news media saw a closed store with the signs of the angry workers, they called the company. And yes, the company confirmed the store had been closed. Yes, they confirmed that workers had quit. They disputed how many and so forth. That's not really interesting. But in the course of this press conference that the Chipotle company wanted to have, because this is very bad publicity, they brought forward one of the two CEOs. This company is not content, like most, to have one CEO. It has two CEOs. One of them, Steve Ells, E-L-L-S, explained that he didn't really understand too well why they were upset, because after all, the starting wage at a Chipotle runs from $8.50 to $9.50 an hour, which he compared favorably with the national minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. Well, I did a little calculation I want to share with you. I assume that a lucky new worker at Chipotle got at the upper end of that range, $9.50 an hour. And I multiplied that by 40 hours a week, and that would make a wage, if you worked a full 40-hour week there, of $380. That, of course, would be your gross pay. You wouldn't take that home because your taxes would be taken out of it, your Social Security would be taken out of it, and you'd end up with what any honest person would say was really lousy pay. And then I asked, and I found, thanks to the Bloomberg News Service in their story covering this on September 10th of 2014, what the two CEOs got. Roughly, the two CEOs each got $25 million in the last year. Okay, let's do the math. The best paid of the new workers at the Chipotle restaurant chain get $380 a week. Each of the two CEOs gets roughly $500,000 a week. That's right. At one end of the company, somebody earns $380 a week, and at the other end of the company, a person goes home with $500,000 a week. So the worker plays the lottery and hopes. The CEO doesn't have to play the lottery. He's got a built-in lottery called his job. Every week, he wins. Next update. I wanted to alert you to look up in search engines on your computer, in whatever way you can, a stunning and remarkable commission hearing or set of hearings in Montreal, Canada. The Charbonneau Commission is investigating corruption. And in the construction industry, they've been hearing from a witness named Tony Accurso, who's the head of the largest construction company up in Canada, in that part of Canada, Montreal. And the reason I bring your attention to this is because, even though I don't have the time to go through the details, the commission is asking piercing questions about corruption. And Mr. Accurso, a very smart and quick-witted testimony giver, witness, is explaining that he really doesn't understand why the commission is bothering him, because, yes, he spread money all over the place, but that's what business involves. That's what every business involves. That's what every one of his competitors is doing, and that's what's being done across Canada. And I would assure my listeners, that's what's being done in the United States, too. Underneath the veneer of corporate executives giving us good advice about economics, there is a corrupt process of buying contracts and buying government approvals and having politicians and big businesses serving each other in the most unethical and illegal often ways you could want. It's not often that we get the curtain pulled aside and can see. Thanks to the Charbonneau Commission in Montreal, and you can actually see the hearings and read a lot about it, the veil is pulled back, and you can get a chance to see something that I can assure you is no more Canadian than it is American, or indeed in many other parts of the world. Okay, that's all the time we have for the short updates. It is, I can assure you, quite frustrating for me, since there are so many others that I would like to talk to you about. But I want to get to the couple of our bigger issues, and then I particularly want to spend an extra portion of time today on the questions you've sent in that I can at least give some kind of answer to. So let's pick up where we left off last week, when I devoted a good part of what we were doing to a discussion of the history and the current situation of socialism. Let me remind you, as an economist, what socialism has meant in the past, which is what we summarized last week, so that I can then go on and talk to you about the changes of the economics of socialism that are underway now. What we summarized last week was this, that over the last 250 years, and particularly in the 19th century and through most of the 20th century, socialism came to mean something very particular. Number one, a critique of capitalism, an argument that capitalism as a system was flawed, and number two, an argument that socialism had a better alternative to propose in its place. First, the basic critique, that capitalism was undemocratic, the socialists argued, because it allowed economic power, the decision of what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, was in the hands of a tiny group of people, those who owned enterprises and those who worked at the very top of the hierarchy that decided things in enterprises, the major shareholders, if you like, and the boards of directors they select to run the company. These are a tiny group of people, and they have all the economic power. And the socialists said they run the economy most and first of all for themselves. So, of course, the socialists said, capitalism is a system that becomes ever more unequal because the decisive economic power is in the hands of a minority who use it to enrich themselves. And the second critique that the socialists made of capitalism was of the institution of the market. They said the market is a way of distributing goods and services. I'll give you three of these if you give me $4. I will use $6 to buy those tomatoes over there. We distribute the goods that are produced by all of us. We redistribute it amongst ourselves by buying and selling from one another, by engaging in what is called market exchange. And the socialist critique is that's not an ethical, moral, or desirable arrangement. We shouldn't give goods and services, first and foremost, to those who have the most money. We ought to distribute the fruits of what we all produce in altogether different ways. We should consider how much need people have. We should consider what the goals of our society are in terms of 5, 10, and 15 years down the road. We should have a debate about what we need the most, rather than simply distribute goods into the hands of those who have the most money, particularly because markets tend not to question how they got the money, the folks who have it. Did they work hard for it? Did they inherit it? Did they steal it? Who knows? We don't care. The money buys the output. So socialists made that criticism. Capitalism was, of course, the system they criticized, where the means of production, factories, offices, stores, were owned by private individuals, and where the distribution system was indeed the market. And finally, to recap, socialism offered an alternative. Instead of privately owned factories, offices, and stores, they proposed to socialize it. That meant in practice that the government would take over, either regulating tightly what the private enterprises could do, or basically pushing the private owners aside and taking over the enterprises, as was done, for example, in Russian industry, in Chinese industry, and so on. As socialists, they wanted the industry to serve the mass of people, and government takeover was, in the minds of traditional socialists, the way to get that done. And lastly, the socialists said, we propose to distribute goods and services by a planned arrangement, one that the society would discuss and debate and agree upon. Not to distribute goods and services to those who have the most money, or at least not most things, but to distribute them by a plan based on political debates and discussions and agreements about what our society needed, what was a fair distribution, and so on. This kind of conflict between capitalism as private enterprise and markets versus socialism as government enterprise and planning by the government has been the big debate in economics for the 19th and most of the 20th century. But socialism, like capitalism, has changed. And that isn't very well understood. Socialists have changed in a way that is particularly unknown. And so when we come back after our mid-program break, that's what I'm going to focus on to show everyone where socialism is going, why it is changing, and what that means for the capitalism with which socialism struggles. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update, the second half of this week's program. I want to welcome you, as I always do, to the second half by reminding you of our two websites, where you can follow all the kinds of analysis we do on this program, and where likewise you can communicate with us and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest simply by clicking the icon that you'll find at both of these two websites. RDWolf, W-O-L-2-F's, rdwolf.com is one, and democracyatwork.info is the other. rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Before the break, we were talking about traditional socialism and its battle with capitalism. Well, the socialists were able, in the 20th century, to take power in a whole host of countries. Some, they took power in the form of taking over enterprises and really imposing a kind of government plan on what the economy did. Those were Russia and China and places like that. In other parts of the world, socialists also took power. For example, they control the government in France today and in many other countries, where they did a kind of softer version. They didn't take over enterprises and they didn't impose big plans on the economy. All they did was impose a lot of government regulation, high taxes, lots of rules, in the hope that they could make the society work better for the mass of people than if they left capitalism to the capitalists. That's sort of what the French, and indeed the European social democracies, that's what they are. It's another kind of socialism, but it again has this idea that you want to reduce the power of private enterprise and the market and increase the relative importance of the government as regulator or owner of enterprise, and as the planner shaping, if not replacing, the market. Well, the experiences in Russia and China have allowed capitalists to make very powerful arguments against socialism. One of those arguments, and indeed the most important, is that if you give as much power to the government as the socialists seem to want to do and did do in places like Russia and China, you run the risk that the government becomes so powerful that it not only shapes the economy the way the socialists said, but becomes a kind of autocracy, a kind of totalitarian power dictating not only what happens economically, but politically, culturally, and every other way. Capitalists found a new argument against socialism by saying it leads to dictatorships of the sort that the communist parties of Russia and China illustrate. And a lot of people found these arguments persuasive, including among socialists. For example, throughout the history of the 20th century, for sure, there have been socialists who were critical of Russia and China, who went so far as to say they don't deserve the name of socialism because they haven't done what socialists wanted, create a society that serves the mass of people who are in charge. It's rather the government, which is a minority, not the mass of people, and it is, seems to be in charge. And sometimes these people, and they come from a variety of persuasions and theoretical notions within socialism, sometimes these people prefer to call Russia and China state capitalism. In other words, it's still like capitalism, a minority who control the society. It's just not the old minority, private individuals who become wealthy, who own companies, who start businesses. No, instead it's government officials who come in and take over. But that's changing one minority to another. It's not the democratic make the economy serve and be run by the people. This socialist idea, they felt, hadn't been realized in Russia and China and societies like that. And so they wanted to go in another way. Meanwhile, capitalism has in fact, while being effective in turning people away from the traditional socialism as it was exemplified, particularly in Russia, China, and societies like that, the same capitalism, which was successful pretty much in that, found itself once again doing what socialists always said it was going to do. Namely, over the last 40 years, particularly the last half century, basically, producing once again growing inequality and exhibiting once again instability, those business cycles or economic crises that socialists always reproached capitalism for. Indeed, in 2007, we had another of these economic downturns, second only in its severity and its longevity to the great crash of capitalism in the 1930s. So capitalism was becoming more vulnerable to socialism, even as the traditional socialism focused on the government was turning off many of the very people for whom socialism had been an attractive idea. Well, the socialists haven't been asleep. They've reacted to all of this, and it's that reaction that I want to talk to you about a little bit. That is, socialism has begun taking new directions. Now, the socialists that are doing this are people who still believe that enterprises ought to be owned by the society as a whole. They shouldn't be under the control of individuals. That's not an acceptable, it's an undemocratic way of organizing things. So that remains. And the notion that there should be planning, that the goods and services should be distributed in our society based on a notion of how we want our society to develop, rather than a notion, if you have more money, you get more, regardless of what the impact of that is on society, regardless of what things don't get done, regardless of how you ever got the money that you have now lavishly to spend. This seems to socialists to be still a good idea. But what the socialists have also begun to do is to focus not on the government. It's not the government they want to bring in to get democracy in our economy. It's not the government they want to bring in to plan things so much. They have a different idea, a different focus. The focus of socialists more and more is on the low level, the level of where people live, not the government far away in some capital city, not the government far away in the sense of a minority of people who take power into their hands. So the new focus of socialism is on the enterprise, on the community, the local community. And the basic idea is this. An enterprise, a workplace, whether it's a factory, a store, or an office, ought to be organized differently from the way capitalism does. In capitalism, a tiny group of people, the major shareholders, in most corporations, 10 or 20, who select the board of directors, in most corporations, 15 or so people. That's together 25 folks, more or less. They make all the decisions. Even if the company employs hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, it's still a tiny group of major shareholders and the board of directors they alone select. Wow. The argument of the socialists is this is undemocratic, unfair, and unhealthy. We shouldn't have a society in which the millions of people who do the work have to live with the decisions made by a minority they do not select, do not elect, hardly know, and have no control in any organized way, have no control over them. This is unacceptable. And particularly if the decisions made by these tiny minorities who control enterprises are to enrich themselves while everybody else is having a harder and harder time making ends meet, well, then this is a doubly unacceptable arrangement. And the socialists say capitalism's problems, the growing inequality, the inefficiency of having huge unemployment, the cycles that throw people out of work by the millions every few years, these are results, the socialists now are arguing, of having enterprises organized in this way. And their counterargument is, if you want an economic system that serves the people, you've got to put the people in charge. And if having the government do it didn't work out the way we wanted, we have to learn from that and do it in a different way. And the way they propose is that enterprises should be organized as cooperatives. And what they mean by that is something very particular, because the word co-op or cooperative has been used to mean many different things. What they want it to mean, and this is extremely important, is that all the workers together, democratically, one worker, one vote, decide what the enterprise will produce, how the enterprise will go about producing it, where the enterprise will be located, and what is done with the profits that, after all the workers helped to produce. And not only should the workers democratically make those decisions, but if, where, and when those decisions impact the broader community, well, then the broader community has to be brought into the decision-making operation. That really towns, cities, should be governed by a kind of legislature that comes out of the workplace, democratically operating and elected, and a legislator that comes out of the places of residence, the way we now do our politics, and they should each have vetoes on the other so that the decisions are the decisions that the democratic people as residents make together with the same people as workers, because their interest as residents and their interest as workers are different, and this legislator would work it out. There'd be no government bureaucracy that controls everything. Everything would be controlled from the bottom. And the people would really have the control because the workers would be disposing of the profits. And the politicians couldn't be making cozy deals with this or that executive, this or that company owner, because they'd have to make the deal with all of the workers since they together own and operate the enterprises. So the socialists are saying, the problem with capitalism is it creates an unfair, undemocratic power position for a tiny minority of people who enrich themselves by means of that control. And the problems of capitalism flow from that situation. And the way to correct it is to pick up on an old idea of American history, cooperative enterprises. Co-ops have existed in America from our beginnings, from before the time we were even an independent country. Many of the religious groups that came to the United States believed in cooperative enterprise for moral, ethical, and religious reasons. So we have a lot to build on in our nation's history in going beyond capitalism, the socialists say, to a system that will better serve us and that we need now more than ever. Socialism has changed its focus. It's looking right at the enterprise and seeing there a way to advance the interests of its longstanding criticism of capitalism without running into the problem of autocratic governments, which were, in a sense, the lesson of the 20th century for socialists. That struggle between a newly directed and a newly focused socialism on the one hand and a capitalism ever more vulnerable because of the inequalities it's breeding, because of the cycles it's imposing on people. This is a struggle whose dimensions is shifting. It's going to be our lives caught up in that struggle one way or another for many, many years to come. Okay, I'm going to turn now not to the other major discussion I had scheduled, but rather to begin to work my way through those of your questions that we have selected because they are very good questions. They are questions that many people have. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on many of them rather than a lot of time on only one or two, which is what I normally do, partly as an experiment to see how this works and hopefully to get some feedback from all of you as to this adjustment in our programming, and whether you like it, want more of it, less of it, and so on. So please don't hesitate to vote with your email through our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Okay, first question. Many businesses in the world run through the franchise system. What the franchise system is a way for a corporation that has lots of units scattered around the country. Think in terms of a restaurant chain. You could have a company that operates restaurants in 50 cities across the United States, and it all operates them from a central headquarters, say in Chicago or New York or St. Louis or someplace. There's an alternative called the franchise system. In this case, the big company finds local people in each of the cities where it operates, and it proposes to them that they set up a local business with whatever the name of the parent company is, and that they become a franchisee. What this means is that the actual restaurant in the locality is the property of the local people. They can use the name, and you know the names of some of these, McDonald's, Burger King, Chipotle, and all the rest. What this means is a contract is signed between the parent company and the local owner. That gives the local owner the right to use that name. In exchange, the parent company requires the local owner typically to buy raw materials from the parent company, to buy the machinery from the parent company. The parent company may pay for the advertising that brings customers to the local, but it's a kind of a partnership between the big company, which still controls the whole thing, and the local-owned company that depends on the big one, but has at least a formal independence. Many companies use this because it's another way of making money. They can often require that the local family kick in a big chunk of money at the beginning to even be able to do this sort of thing. So it allows the company to make extra money. It has all kinds of advantages, tax advantages, and so on. But one of your questions is, could this franchise system be the basis for a way to create collective enterprises? Wow, very interesting idea, one I had never thought of. And I've been thinking about it since the question came in back in the latter part of August. And I think the answer is yes. I think the franchise model might be a very interesting one in which what you would do if you wanted to build up a cooperative sector of the economy would be to set up a program, perhaps a government program, to help groups of people who wanted to be the franchise partner of a larger enterprise, enable them to set up a cooperative enterprise as the local representative, and maybe change the laws in the country to require large parent companies to actually be reformed as companies, each of which are run by a council sent by a representative elected out of each local co-op to sit on the boards of the parents. Then the whole thing would be a co-op, with the top controlled by the bottom, because the bottom is where the actual business is done by a local co-op, and they will only remit profits and do what the central co-op does if they are satisfied and pleased with how that central co-op works. In other words, as Karl Marx himself loved to write, capitalism develops inside itself many of the mechanisms that socialists can and will adapt later as they fashion the next system in human history. Next was a question about growth. Isn't capitalism driven by growth, and isn't that self-destructive? This is an old point, and it comes out of the socialist tradition, which criticized capitalism often for being kind of a blindly growth-driven kind of economic system. So let's look at it for a moment. On one level, this is absolutely true. Every capitalist is under pressure to grow. Why? Well, the capitalist knows if I grow, if I have more workers and produce more output, I'm going to get more profit in all likelihood. And with the extra profit, I'm going to be able, perhaps, to outcompete other companies that are producing what I produce. Why? Because if I have more profits, I can buy the latest technology. I'll have enough money to do it. If I need a better lawyer, I'll have the extra money to hire a better lawyer. If I need to spend more on advertising, by having grown, I have the extra profits to pay for it. If I don't grow and my profits don't expand, then I have to be in mortal terror that one of my competitors will grow, will earn more profits, and will be able to pay the lawyer, pay the advertising, buy the new machine, and then outcompete me because I can't afford that. So the laws of competition drive companies to constantly increase production. And the result of that, though actually many results of it, have been to be on the one hand, make capitalism a rapidly growing economic system. That's what the defenders of capitalism love to point to. Look, everybody's under pressure to grow, and the end result is our system grows. And true enough, the history of capitalism has been the history of quite rapid growth compared with other systems earlier in human history. But there's a flip side here which has to be taken into account. Number one, if every capitalist grows, then periodically you run the risk that if everybody's expanding production to all the competitors at the same time, they're going to end up with more output and perhaps more output than people can afford to buy. That's often called the problem of overproduction. And you've sent me questions about that too. And here it is. Overproduction periodically happens. It's a kind of craziness of capitalism in which the way it works leads everybody to produce more and more and then periodically to discover, I've produced more, which I'm trying to sell. My competitors have produced more, and there simply isn't enough buying power or interest in the public to buy all we've produced. But that then becomes a serious problem because capitalists have spent money to buy raw materials to produce what they now can't sell. They've hired workers to whom they owe wages who have produced stuff they can't sell. They're now in trouble. They may collapse as a business because they've spent all this money to produce what they cannot recoup in sales. This is often the cause of an economic downturn. Overproduction leading to a collapse of profits, leading businesses to lay off workers, to cut back on their orders. That then plunges other businesses into economic distress, and down goes the economy. That's not the fault of government. That's not the fault of individual capitalists. It's the fault of a system that drives all capitalists under pain of extinction to constantly grow. And so it is a serious problem of capitalism. It lacks the coordination that could prevent that from happening, which is why it has happened over and over again in the history of capitalism right up into the present time. The second consequence of growth that it agitates people a great deal is that since every capitalist has to grow, no capitalist can worry about the side effects of growth. For example, the destruction of the environment, the exhaustion of the working class, a whole list of disastrous byproducts of the capitalist fetish of growing, 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 that can come back to haunt us, that can make us regret that we didn't much earlier slow down the pace of growth, redirect growth from more and more things to more and more services that don't take up the resources of the earth in the same way, etc. But to have planned the economy is precisely what capitalism does not allow, denounces as socialism, so it keeps growing and growing, hitting a wall, collapsing, causing a crisis, degrading the environment. These are the outcomes of a fetish to grow that raise questions about capitalism as a system precisely because it is so focused on growth. I want to thank the person who wrote in after we spoke last week about how much cheaper cell phone usage is in Great Britain compared to the United States. They actually charge a good bit less for better monthly plans than in the United States. I want to thank the reader who wrote in and told me about the free service. That's not a service without a charge. It's the name of the company, France, in short, offers also much cheaper packages of cell phone service than the United States. Okay, next question that came in I want to respond to. This had to do also with a response to my discussion last week about the importance of advertising. And this questioner says, if I heard you right, you said that goods and services are produced for needs that aren't really there, that are only created by advertising. Well, I don't think I said that, but of course, you know, what I said and what you heard are things that depend on both of us. So let me try to clarify here and now. Of course, we all have needs and desires. Advertising doesn't start with a blank slate. It can't make us desire something we have in our own minds no interest in. But what's advertising does is strengthen and emphasize some of our desires and repress, deny, or marginalize others. And yes, advertising sometimes develops in us a taste for things we would not have otherwise developed a taste for. All of that's true. My point was only that economists in general like to work with a model of the economy in which you have producers, companies, enterprises, that are looking around for what people want and then devoting themselves to producing that. So that we're supposed to look at the economy and celebrate, isn't it wonderful what all these companies are producing, because we want that. I wanted to make it clear that that's a fantasy, that corporations long ago stopped depending on what people want and then figuring out what to produce. They said to themselves, wait a minute, we could make much more profit if we produced X rather than Y. People seem to prefer Y to X, so we can't do that unless we change their preferences, unless we inundate them with countless pictures of famous basketball players and actresses and others who love this object, suggesting to them, you will love the object, so that we can shift them over from drinking this to drinking that, from wearing this to wearing that, because we want to make these other goods because there's more profit in it. The desires we have today are heavily shaped by advertising. It's not that we bring nothing of our own to our desires. Of course, our families shape our desires, our larger community does, our jobs do, but the directed goal of corporations is to manipulate our demands so that they can supply what it is most profitable for them to produce. Well, as I feared, there are still many more questions from those we've selected, let alone from all those you've set in. But let me hear from you. If you wish, I will spend more time next week than I did even this week responding to questions rather than the other things we normally do. Thank you so much for spending your time with me. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.